Podcasting from the beautiful San Francisco Bay Area in California, this is Venus Rising, where we discuss all things related to big fertility and encourage you to think beyond the masses. I'm Callie Fell, your host, bringing you the best and most up-to-date conversations on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health. Hello, and welcome back to Venus Rising. Today, we have the opportunity to talk with Kylie Kukowski. Kylie was born in Bozeman, Montana, but as the daughter of a retired colonel in the Air Force, she had the opportunity to live in 9 different states. After graduating from college, Kylie moved to Florida, where she made the life-altering decision to become an egg donor. Kylie was featured in our award-winning documentary titled Exploitation, which you can watch for free on Amazon Prime. Professionally, Kylie has a background in real estate and property management, but is currently working as an esthetician and professional makeup artist. Kylie currently lives in Texas with her husband, 2 dogs, and cat. Welcome to Venus Rising, Kylie.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Kylie, I have heard and read about your story many times, and I'm grateful for an opportunity to sit down and chat with you. Most recently, you shared your story with the Coalition Against Trafficking in Women on a webinar they hosted in light of commercial surrogacy becoming legal in New York State. I appreciate your willingness to continue to share your horrific story. And if you don't mind, that's where I'd like to start today. Tell me about your decision to donate your eggs. How did you become interested in it? And what was the process for you like?
Sure, absolutely. And again, thank you so much for having me. And I appreciate being able to share a little bit of my story as well. So as far as how I got into egg donation, I was living in Florida at the time. And I had come across an ad for becoming an egg donor. I was somewhat freshly out of college, but I was working and just trying to figure out career paths and finances and, you know, student loan debt and starting to pay all that stuff back. So of course it was just, you know, just coming into full adulthood, if you will. So I come across the ad for egg donation, and I didn't know much about it, but obviously the price tag on it to become an egg donor that you would be able and be eligible to be paid stood out to me. And I thought, okay, well, let me just do a little bit more research, see what this is about. It could be a great, you know, payment towards student loans or, you know, just any type of debt that I had at the time, but didn't know much about it, didn't think much of it. And so over the next couple months, I had seen a few more ads and decided at that point, I had done a little bit of research online, and just said, okay, let me figure out a little bit more about this. Let me reach out and see what this looks like. And so I had reached out to the agency and they gave me a very brief description. They said it was very, very simple. You just basically are, kind of equated it to almost like a dating app or a dating website where you create a profile. And if the intended family or parents like your profile and it's a match, then you would move forward. And so it was very almost lighthearted, but you know, they were just saying, oh, you're doing such a great thing and you're helping out these families and all that stuff. And so they said the process to be included in the egg donation, like the egg donor program, was fairly simple. You just had to create a profile. It was extensive as far as the questions go, but simple as long as you knew the history of health history and things like that with your family, with you know, all the very basic stuff.
Was it all self-reported as far as like?
Yes.
They didn't do any type of medical or genetic testing or psychological screening for you?
So that came in later. So that came in once families would choose you.
Okay.
So they, I think, you know, obviously that's the much more economically feasible to do, to not pay all that up front unless someone wants you. And then all of a sudden, then they start paying those tests for you.
I see.
So once a family chose me, then the testing and everything, it was just through the roof, all the stuff that you had to do. Very invasive health history, like you said, psychological testing, genetic testing, sexual disease testing. I mean, absolutely everything. So
okay.
Much different experience once they selected you.
So let's talk about the advertisement. What was the advertisement like? Where did you kind of come across that? Do you remember?
So, yep, I do. So it was on Craigslist, actually. And that was when Craigslist was still pretty popular. So yeah. It was a while ago.
It dates it was, a little, doesn't it?
No, a little bit. Yep. And it's just funny. Yeah. I haven't been on Craigslist probably since then, to be honest. So it was just a very simple ad, and it just said, you know, egg donors wanted in your area. And then they gave kind of a pay scale, and they say, you know, you can make up to X amount of money based on certain qualifications, or I don't remember the exact wording that they used. Mm-hmm. And then they said, we'd love to hear from you. Please click on this link to find out more, or something like that. So right. Very, very basic, kind of the stuff that nowadays you would look at and be like, okay, that's a scam kind of a deal. But back in the day, that did not cross my mind. So,
well, I've seen several advertisements, and a popular place for those are college campuses, because young ladies there, and they are very flowery and promise all good things. Kind of, it usually lists an amount and shows these really happy girls on the ad, and makes you feel like, you know, you're answering a call to be an angel, so to speak.
Yes, 1,000%.
And I recently, you kind of talked about this in your own story, that you were drawn to it to help you with your debt, your college expenses. And there's a new article by Diane Tober that evaluated the role, or looked at or talked about the role of student loan debt and egg donation. And it seems that women in America seem to be selling their eggs so they can afford an education. Do you think, kind of looking back now, do you think that fertility clinics take advantage of that? Or do you think that young women are targeted in that way?
So I would say absolutely. I think you're targeted for being young, healthy, college educated, or in the process of becoming college educated. I know that when I went through the agency, they said that was one of the biggest features of a profile, was your educational background, surprisingly. And I think, I don't know if intended parents look at that from whether that's genetic or inherited, I'm not quite sure, but I'm sure it's a little bit of everything. But I think they like the idea of potentially getting an egg that has the potential for things like that. So yeah, they're targeting these women that are young, typically, younger anyways, and trying to figure out what they're doing with their lives, and almost not at a crossroads, not that dramatic, but just figuring things out and, potentially being a little bit more trusting, maybe not as many horrific experiences through their life that would make them question things a little bit more. Sure. I think it's this whole rounded approach of just exploiting these women for financial reasons and physical health reasons, and not necessarily, women that would be questioning a ton of things.
Sure. Well, and fertility clinics, we associate, I think, with doctors, with medical professionals, and we have a trust in those people and in that system,
Yes, absolutely. And that was one of the biggest things. I actually talked about it with my husband and my family, well after the fact. And to this day, unfortunately, I have a very jaded view of doctors just because of this experience. And it shouldn't be that way. Obviously, not everyone, did what happened to me. Right. But it's just this now just deep kind of thing that I have.
Right. You're going to kind of look at them sideways,
Yes.
Yeah. It's interesting. I was doing a little research and just refreshing my own memory, and the American Society of Reproductive Medicine actually recommends that egg donors be at least 21 years or older. But there's a study that shows that advertisements placed by egg donor recruitment agencies actually list the minimum age as 18 and 20. So these clinics aren't even adhering to any type of recommendation, and it's not being regulated. So just a kind of a just interesting to me, I guess, since we're talking about age and young women and the whole system. So let's get back a little bit to your story. When you signed up, made your profile, did you sign any type of informed consent? Did you sign any type of contract? Did you feel like you completely understood risks? Were they explicitly told of any risks or adverse effects about ovarian stimulation and the retrieval process?
Becoming an egg donor, no, I don't remember any sort of health concerns or things I had to sign. I think I had to sign consents to be with the agency and what would be as part of the contract of being part of the agency, but nothing health related. Once we got further into the program and when they started getting into the genetic testing and psychological testing, they started introducing the next steps of the hormones that you'd be taking. And I remember not a lot of health concern paperwork or discussions. The only little bit that I remember was at one of the doctor's appointments, and they said, oh yeah, just, you have to sign this piece of paper stating that there's always risks involved with, you know, health things, but it's very rare. And generally speaking, people that have symptoms are going to be very, very mild, and this is what it's going to look like. And they never went into the very extreme cases, just because they said it's so rare and not common and, you know, you're healthy, you shouldn't have any issues, but you just need to sign this anyways.
And I'm finding more and more too, as I talk to different people, not only do they kind of brush over it and say it's not common, but they don't actually even know some of the risks, right? Like these are,
of course, known
risk factors, long-term risk factors. These women who donate their eggs aren't being followed in any type of length.
Yes. Yes. No. And the only symptoms that are, you know, things that they would state, like you said, are the very direct correlated issues, nothing of anything long-term at all. And if anything, they try to stay as far away from that as possible and, you know, not try to make those correlations, because I think it would obviously be bad for the industry.
So let's continue with your story. You created a profile. It sounds like you got matched. Tell us about getting matched and what you knew or didn't know about possible intended parents. Let's talk about getting matched in that process.
So yeah, so the agency reached out to me, and it was a closed agency agreement, if you will. So I knew nothing of the intended parents.
Okay.
The only thing I knew was their location, because that's where I would have to travel for the procedures. So other than that, I knew nothing about them. So the agency reached out and said, you know, congratulations. This family just loved you and thought you were amazing, and said, you know, this is so rare. Generally, we don't match people this quickly, and that just is just fantastic. And so you have this immediate excitement almost around it, like, oh, you know, someone wants me, that whole exploiting of the emotional side of it again. And so they're like, yep, we're going to start this. And they're in Canada. And so you'll have to travel to Canada. They made sure I had my passport and all that stuff. And they said, you know, are you okay traveling internationally and all that stuff that went with it. And then they went into, you know, here's the long list of all the testing we'll have to have you do, and here's the timing, and here's the time frame we're looking at. And then we won't know the exact dates for retrieval, because it's based on the intended mother's cycle, not yours. And they have to try to match it. And so they just said, we'll start going through this. You know, this still doesn't mean that it's going to be completed all the way through, because if you don't pass something or they don't like what they see on the testing, you know, they could pull out. But basically, I'm pushing forward, you know, regardless.
I see.
And so then, yeah, then it just started a very long, very invasive process for, I don't remember how long it was prior, maybe 6 months worth of testing. And not that it took 6 months to test everything, but it just, you know, every little thing had to be tested, and
there
was timing and all that stuff involved. And so just a very long, drawn out process, tons of blood work, tons of, you know, every sort of testing that we've discussed. And they went further into the like family health history, and they wanted to know everything in the family tree and basically what makes me me. And so, and a lot of that was vetted and confirmed, and, you know, all the stuff that goes into that, which I don't know as much on their side, but you're just kind of sitting waiting until another box gets checked, and then you move to the next one, kind of a deal.
Gotcha. So how long was your profile up before you were matched?
Very quickly. So I would say probably, and this is completely by memory, but it was within a month. And I, if to be more specific, I'd say probably a couple weeks. So it was not long.
And so you had to fly from, at the time you were in Florida, to Canada. How often were you having to go back and forth?
So I went to Canada twice. The first time I went, and both times were, well, the first time was very close to when the retrieval was happening. It was, I think, maybe a month ahead of time. And that trip was to meet the doctor who was going to perform the surgery, mm-hmm. or the retrieval, I should say, and to give me the medication that was required for the retrieval.
Sure.
They did say that the medication in Canada wasn't approved in the United States, I believe is what they said, but how they, which should have been obviously a major red flag, but they, the way they explained it away was it was just logistics through the FDA, but the US had the same medication, but just not the Canadian brand of medication.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Saying that, I don't know what was true in that or not, but so they're like, you just have to go there. It has to be the Canadian medication to perform it in Canada. But then they said, just be careful flying home with it, basically. So I'm like, okay. So you had this like immediate, like, oh my gosh, am I going to get in trouble? Or are they going to stop me at the at customs, you know, all this stuff. But so anyway, so that was the first trip. And then, and just, and I don't even know if I remembered this fully, but I just thought of it talking with you. I remember even the agency being very stealthy with me and just saying, oh my gosh, this family just loves you. And they're so nice. They're wanting to put you up in like the nicest places and really take care of you. And, you know, that's even above like the budget we gave them. And so this whole time they were pushing how nice this family was, mm-hmm. and how wonderful this family was. And again, looking back, you don't know what was true or what wasn't. You don't know if that's just their way of making sure that you're getting emotionally attached to their family more. You know, you always wonder those little things after the fact. So yeah, sorry, continue.
No, you go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off. I'm sorry.
No. I can ramble on for a while. So
that's okay. I always tell people that my, you know, the listeners here, they want to hear from you. So
good. So then that was the first trip to Canada. Now the doctor gave me the medication to take myself. So it was all self-administered, but he went through everything, explained everything. And at that point it was very invasive for medication because you're self-injecting shots and you have to measure everything. And I just remember being really not liking that aspect of things. Not that I couldn't, you know, do a syringe and all that stuff, not the pain wise, but just, it's a lot of responsibility to put on a person who's not familiar with the process. And so I said, okay, you know, we'll do it. We'll figure it out. And so they had reached out and they didn't tell me right away when to start the medication because they said, again, it was based on the intended mother's cycle.
Sure.
And so they said they would let me know when to start my cycle. And so I think they'd reached out maybe a week or two later and they said, hey, here's what's happening. The intended mother has a cycle coming up and we can have you do it this month, but there's some storms coming and it's about to be winter. Cause I know that my retrieval date was in end of October. Okay. And because it was in Canada, they said we won't be able to perform it over the winter due to storms and blizzards and things like that. And so they said, it's either now or we can't do it for another 3 to 6 months. And if you wait, we'll probably have to retest you on a bunch of things. Hmm. So then it became a kind of a, not a pushy, but we need to do this now.
Yeah.
Yes. And, you know, they're relying on you to do it now because if not, you know, they're going to have to wait and this is going to be your fault if we have to wait, kind of a deal. Mm. So it ended up being a lot faster than I was anticipating. But again, you feel guilty and you feel bad and you're like, okay, no, I can make it work. And so I started the medication and it was about, I don't know, maybe a week or two of medication. And I said, you'll start doing these shots and then we'll do the final shot when you're back up in Canada. And that final shot, they call it like a trigger shot. And so that will release the eggs that have been building up in your ovaries. And once you're up here, we'll do the shot, they'll release and then we can retrieve them.
Sure. Okay.
And so I started the injections, and each day I got progressively more uncomfortable. So I remember getting bloated and kind of crampy and headaches, just like, so I would say stronger, almost like PMS symptoms. Mm-hmm. And so I remember calling because normally I'm fairly fortunate and don't have a lot of those symptoms with my normal monthly cycles. And so it was a little bit strange to me that I was starting to happen now.
And concerning, you know, you started medication.
Yes, exactly. You know. And so I, out of just caution, called the agency and said, hey, this is what's happening. You know, is this normal? Is this not normal? And they're like, oh, no, you're fine. That's completely normal. It's okay. You're good. You know, that kind of thing.
Were you calling the agency in Florida? Was that your main like hub of contact, or were you calling Canada?
So I was calling the agency, and the agency itself, I think, if I'm not mistaken, was based in either Iowa or Ohio.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I never actually met them. I met them through a couple of video chats, but never in person.
Okay.
But they, again, had a very strict policy that everything went through them. And so I really didn't talk to the doctor at all. And everything went through the agency.
I see.
And they said, okay, we'll talk to the doctor. We'll do this. But that initial conversation, I remember them saying, nope, this is very normal symptoms. You're okay. And so, and I'm thinking, oh, well, you know, they've done this hundreds of thousands of times, I'm sure. And they know, you know, mm-hmm. So you're always just kind of passing the wisdom from them, basically.
Sure.
And so each day just progressively getting more uncomfortable, but I'm like, okay, this is normal. And then you start telling yourself, okay, you're the crazy one. Like, just get over it. Be tough. You're okay. And so then I go up for the procedure and up to Canada. Yes. Okay. I fly up to Canada. And I remember vividly, I remember it was around Halloween. And that's the only reason I remember that, because you just see these, you know, crazy costumes in the street and, mm-hmm.
Decoration. You know,
Canada, yeah. Yes. And I didn't know, but Canada, I guess, does a very large Halloween thing up there. So I just remember that vividly for some reason. And so I'm up there and they do all the pre-testing, and the doctor was like, oh my gosh, you're doing so great. There is so many, they call them follicles, but so many eggs, so many, you know, you've just responded so well to the medication. We're just so impressed. This is awesome. And so, of course, you just get that emotional pat on the back, like, okay, I'm doing good. My body's doing what it's supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, I think at that point too, like, this is, I'm uncomfortable. At this point, I couldn't actually fit into my clothes. And I mean, this has only been a week or two. This is not very long. And I remember not being able to fit into my pants and just being so bloated and so uncomfortable. And at this point it was past bloating. Like, it was... Right. I was putting on weight and retention, like water retention and all that stuff.
Do you have any idea how much weight that you had gained?
So I didn't know up until that point, but when I got home at the hospital, I was 40 pounds heavier.
Wow.
In a two and a half week span. And so we scheduled for the retrieval the next day. And I remember going in, and the doctor, of course, was just very nice, very friendly, comfortable, the whole bit. And so I remember going into the procedure and they said, you'll be awake, but we're going to knock you out a little bit, but you'll still be coherent. So you can talk to the doctor if you need to. But they said, oh, you won't feel anything, but you'll be, you know, kind of out of it. And I remember about halfway through feeling really, 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 really uncomfortable and painful. And I remember laying down on the doctor's table. And it's almost like an ultrasound where you're laying there and the doctor's in with like the tools, getting like retrieving the eggs, and you can see the screen. And so you can see where the needle is going in and pulling them out. And so I remember seeing that screen of seeing the eggs going.
Wow.
And it's like,
I don't know that I want to see that.
No. And at the time you're loopy and drugged out and you're like, huh, that's, you know, and you just, but you're not fully understanding what's happening. Hmm. And I remember getting really uncomfortable towards the end. And I was like, okay, I'm in pain. And he's like, nope, it's okay. You're okay. This is normal. There's a few more. And I just remember almost crying like on the table because it was starting to just be really uncomfortable. And I don't know if it was just like the psychological side. I don't know if it was full pain. I don't know if it was a mix, but something was triggering me a little bit. And so finally they wrapped up and they're like, you did so great. We'll bring you into the recovery room. Well, the recovery room was terrible. And I say that only because the front of the doctor's office was beautiful and comfortable and inviting and everything that you would hope it would be in that type of environment. And then the recovery room was cold and dark and it was like night and day different. And it was that immediate, like, okay, you were just a product for them. And now you did your purpose and now you're done. Like, we don't need you anymore.
Yeah.
So it was almost like you just were thrown in the trash. Like that was a just night and day different. And so they said, when you are kind of fully awake, we'll, you know, make sure you're fully awake and then you can be on your way and you're good. And so, I don't know how long I was there for, but maybe an hour, I don't know, 30 minutes, something like that. Not very long. And I remember getting checked out to leave. And the minute I brought a friend with me and the minute, because you needed someone to go with you, you couldn't do this by yourself.
Right.
Yes. And traveling and all that stuff. They said, make sure you bring someone with you.
Did they provide the expenses for the person to come with you then?
That's a good question. I believe so. Mm-hmm. I believe so. And they stayed in the same room with me, and I think it was just the flight. So they didn't have to pay extra other than the flight, if I'm not mistaken. I could be wrong on that though. That was something I don't fully remember.
Yeah. But no, I was just curious if.
Yeah. And that's a good question. So I remember leaving and getting into the elevator and I was still really drowsy, but they cleared me to go. And I immediately threw up, and I didn't know I was going to throw up. Like it was just immediate. Like it was just a body reaction on the elevator, like couldn't stop it. Couldn't do anything. And I was just mortified. And so they ran back in the doctor's office and said, hey, this is what just happened. And they said, oh, she's fine. It's just probably the medication that made her drowsy. Just have her go lay down for a little bit and she'll be okay. And so they brought me back to the room. I fell asleep for probably a few hours and they had to wake me up because I had a flight that night to leave. And so I was leaving that day.
So you you boarded a plane the same day as your exercise surgery.
Yes. And they gave me the option to stay one extra day and leave the following day or to get home. And luckily I got home when I did. I'll say it that way. I chose to get home earlier. I just said, you know, I want to get home. I don't like being in another country, not with family, that whole deal. And so I said, I'll just get home. They said I was cleared to fly. Like they said it was okay. And so I was like, let me just get home. So I had two flights. I think I had one flight and then a connecting flight home. And I remember not much about it, but I just remember almost missing my first flight because I couldn't get out of the bathroom. Almost missing the second flight because I couldn't get out of the bathroom. And sorry for the extra graphic, you know, fun stuff that goes with this, but
don't be sorry. I want you to tell your story and it's okay.
So throwing up, I remember throwing up in the walkway, like the jetway to the airplane. And I had nowhere to go. There was no trash cans. And so I just took my jacket and threw up all in my jacket because it was, and you wouldn't think you would have anything left to get out of your system, but it just would not stop. And so it was just an awful couple of hours. And there was people around me that were extremely nice. And I was trying to get out like, hey, I'm not like, this isn't the flu. This isn't contagious. Like I just had a procedure. You're still
thinking about other people.
And it was just this like whole mortifying experience. Aww. And so luckily there was a couple of people on the flight that were very friendly and helpful and, you know, tried to help as much as they could. And so then we get home to the airport or we get into Florida at the airport and I'm waiting for my luggage and they lost my luggage. I just remember that. And so I was waiting in the baggage claim area and I couldn't even stand up. And so I was, and this just shows you how bad the situation was. I'm a little bit of a neat freak, not crazy, but a little bit. And so I think that probably added to the trauma of me throwing up everywhere. I was laying face down on the carpet in the baggage claim. Like, I could not stand up, and that's how sick I was. And I did not care. Like, if you think about probably how gross that situation is, I did not care at all. So
I'm surprised you made it home. I would have probably thrown it in the towel, you know.
Yes, I wanted to many times. And for some reason, there was just this like guiding force that was just getting me home. Like, somehow, I don't know how, but getting me home.
And it's good you got home. And we'll get to that. I promise, listeners.
So my boyfriend at the time, who did not go with me, but he picked me up at the airport. And he did not know any of this. He did not know that I was sick. He did not know, he knew what I was going to do, but he did not know my experience on the way home.
Right.
And so he gets there and he comes in the airport and he's like, "What are you doing? Like, why are you laying on the carpet in here?" And I was like, "I'm so sick." And he didn't realize the extent of what was happening. So he's like, "You're okay. Let's get you home. Mm-hmm. You'll get better." So then the next couple of days was, and it might have been a day and a half. I don't even know what it was. It wasn't very long. I know it was one night, that first night that we got home. And then I was in the hospital the next night. So I guess 24 hours.
Yeah.
So again, couldn't get out of bed, couldn't do anything. And the doctor had given me medication to take if I was nauseous. He goes, "If you're a little bit nauseous, you can take this and it'll help with the nausea." And so I was trying to communicate to him, like, you know, I need that medicine to help. And so every time I would try it, I would just throw up everywhere. Mm. And so he's trying to give me water. He's trying to give me all this stuff and nothing's working. Mm-hmm. And so eventually I told him, I said, "You need to call the doctor. Like, something is wrong." And so he called the doctor. And so the doctor did tell me, "If there's any issues, you can call me." Mm-hmm. So I was like, "You just need to call him. Like, I can't call the agency. You need to call the doctor." And so he called the doctor and the doctor said, "Nope, this is normal. You know, she's going to probably have still some stuff in her system and she's just getting it out. She's probably really low on electrolytes. So just give her some Gatorade and she'll be better." And so he's like, "Okay, but she's not actually drinking it, you know," and
she can't even keep Gatorade down.
Yes. Yes. So we try all that. Nothing's working. I'm officially now can't even stand up anymore. Mm. And because I just was so weak. He had left for like maybe an hour to run a couple errands and he was coming back. And so you felt so sick that you just wanted to die, but you didn't know it was actually that bad, that it was very possible that was a scenario that could have played out. Mm-hmm. And so I was so, so sick again. And I went to reach for my phone and I remember looking at my phone with my eyes and reaching for it with my hand, and I couldn't actually move my arm. And I was looking at my arm and looking at the phone, and I'm like, "Okay, why is my arm not moving? Like, why can I not get to the phone?" And so I had to kind of spin around, and I could use my other arm. My other arm was working. And so I went to grab the phone with my other arm, and I called him, and I said, "You need to get home right now. Like, there's something wrong." And so he got home right away, and he went to pick me up, to stand me up, because I wanted to try to throw up again. And he went to pick me up and for me to stand, and I completely collapsed because my right side gave out on me. Mm. And so I couldn't move my arm. I couldn't move my face. And I didn't know this at the time, but he told me, like, I wasn't actually talking. Like, I thought I was talking in my brain. I was talking, but I actually wasn't saying anything cohesive. And so he called the ambulance right at that point because he knew something was seriously wrong.
Yeah.
And so the paramedics came and they could tell right away what had happened. I didn't know and never would have crossed my mind in, you know, a million years, but they knew I was having a stroke, or at least the symptoms of a stroke.
Yeah.
And so they took me to a specialty hospital, which I'm very thankful that they did, because they just said it was very rare for my age to have that type of thing. So they thought, okay, let's take her to this hospital. This is probably the best case for her. And so they get me there. I'm not speaking at that point. And he's trying to explain stuff, but doesn't know what to do. And he's freaking out. So he's trying to call my family and get someone there. So the hospital immediately started trying to treat the stroke. And they gave me a bunch of blood thinners because they didn't know what was causing it. And so they pumped a bunch of blood thinners in to make sure that I wasn't having more clots and other issues. And that night my abdomen swelled to look like I was probably 8 or 9 months pregnant. Like it was just that large of fluid. And so then at that point, after doing body scans, they had saw my ovaries and realized that the blood thinners were actually conflicting with the hyperstimulation. And so it caused a bad kind of reaction, but they wouldn't have known that at the time.
Right.
And so they stopped
to treat your stroke, but then you were also diagnosed with ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome.
Yes. And so they couldn't give me the blood thinners anymore because they knew that it was making the other situation worse, but then they couldn't not treat it. So it was a touch and go for that first night. Over the next course, I ended up being at the hospital for about 10 days under the ICU unit, like just the, you know, the top
kind of critical care.
Yes. Thank you. And so they had said once they understood that I wasn't going to actually have another stroke in the process, like not that you could guarantee that, but they just said, okay, this isn't, we know what caused the stroke now, and we don't feel like you're going to have another one. They turned all of their attention towards the ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome because they said, now we thought the stroke was going to be your biggest hurdle, and it still will be a hurdle. Unfortunately, though, right now you could still die because your ovaries are extremely enlarged and could burst, could turn, could rupture. And they said, if any of those situations happen, your blood supply or your oxygen supply gets cut off and you'll die. So they said, we just have to watch you constantly and make sure that they're not expanding more and that they'll start actually receding in size. And so I was seeing, there was a doctor in my room probably every 10 minutes. And it was, and what was happening is all my organs started shutting down. I don't know, just from all the pressure of what was happening with the other stuff. I'm not real sure, but.
Well, your body had a tremendous amount of fluid.
Yes. And so there was like a nephrologist that came in because my kidneys were shutting down. There was a heart specialist because my heart was not working the way it was supposed to. There was an OBGYN because obviously the ovaries, there was a brain doctor because of my stroke. So it was just a revolving door for 10 days, you know, MRI today, CAT scan tomorrow, MRI today. They had to drain fluid out of my abdomen about 3 or 4 different times because every time they would drain it, it would just fill back up. And so eventually they ended up putting one of those draining tubes in because they just said they couldn't keep up with the fluid and they didn't want to have me keep going back and forth. So they ended up putting an actual tube in that would just drain it out throughout the day. Sure. And so it was a whirlwind. I ended up having, I think, 3 blood transfusions during that 10 days. It just because I wasn't getting better and they couldn't get my body to come back from like the internal bleeding and the fluids and just everything that was happening. Mm-hmm. I just think it was a lot on the system. And then I was still combating just the hormones that were in my system and you couldn't get that out. And so they had told me after the fact, like way, way after the fact, that they think the reason I was so sick, or one of the reasons, was if you take like morning sickness when you're pregnant, they say your body has that HCG component and that is almost like a natural detoxing agent. And so your body goes through this detoxing phase and that's what causes some women to have more or less morning sickness based on how much your body's detoxing. And so they said that the trigger shot that they gave me, which had the HCG in it, just produced so, so, so much of that detoxing component, I guess, to the point where it almost shut my body down. Yeah. So it was just a very touch and go situation. And I remember like the first night thinking, okay, I'm probably going to die. Like this is, but my brain wasn't fully engaged because I just was so out of it and so sick and so, you know, just not really me.
And you had a stroke. Your brain went under severe trauma.
Yes. And so then a couple of nights later, after I got through the worst of the sickness and worst of just what I thought was the worst. I remember them coming in and saying, no, like, this is critical. Like, she actually could die now. And I just remember thinking to myself, like, wow, I didn't realize that I wasn't out of the woods yet. Mm-hmm. Like, even though I knew there was a long journey ahead, like, you just didn't realize that it was just one thing after another, after another.
Right.
That, and that happened probably.
What was going on, like, in your family's life, and like thinking like, oh my goodness, we have this young, healthy daughter or, you know, sister or whatever. And now you're just this sick, you know?
Yes. Yeah. No. And they were just at a loss for words, didn't know what to do, didn't know anything. They had gotten the agency's number and had called them just to let them know what was going on. And so they were trying to coordinate with, not coordinate anything with the agency, but just letting them know this is what's happening. Like, you know, just so you know, like, this is what's happening.
Did the agency care? Did they follow up with anything?
They did. Or at least, you know, I think probably for them, it was, they probably cared a little bit. And then all of a sudden it was a liability thing, I'm sure. And again, I don't know what is true or what's not, but at the time they had told my family that they had reached out to the intended parents and told them what was happening, and that the intended parents were waiting for the go-ahead from me to use the eggs. And so they had stopped their process waiting to make sure I was okay. Mm-hmm. And which sounds beautiful, and I really pray that that was true. Mm-hmm. But hindsight, you just don't know what was true or what was not. Right. So, because then I'm thinking, okay, well, the whole purpose was of this was because they had such a tight time schedule. And, right. You know,
that's
so I don't
going
know.
Through my head too. I was like, but I thought it needed to be
yes.
done because
yes.
the intended.
And so,
yeah.
Yeah. So, well, you know, well, and some things we'll just never know, but right. That's okay.
Yeah.
So probably day 5, day 6 was the worst. After initially, like the first day obviously was the worst. And then day 5, day 6 was when it was real bad again. And then that was my last blood transfusion that they had to do. And then they said my body started doing kind of a turnaround, and my blood pressure was starting to stabilize. My heart was starting to stabilize. My kidneys were starting to stabilize. Everything was kind of, they said I wasn't out of the woods, but the initial emergency side of it was out of the woods. But then they just had to wait for my ovaries to start showing signs of improvements before they would even remotely think about releasing me.
Right.
And so at day 10 or day 11, they finally released me. I still had, they weren't, my ovaries weren't small enough to be of no concern, but they said they're small enough that we don't think there's an emergency situation. But they put, they kept the drainage bag in for about 2 months afterwards.
Wow.
And they had a at-home nurse that would come and check on me daily for the 2 months. And so I just was out of the hospital care, but then I had at home care. And so, yeah, so I think mentioned earlier, I think I gained about 40 pounds pre all of this and during that whole stint of the fluids and everything. And then I lost a total of maybe 60 pounds. So then I was lost what I had lost. And then I lost an additional probably 20 or 30 pounds after the fact. So when I was leaving, I went from looking 8 to 9 months pregnant to then looking sickly and frail and the other opposite side.
Now, how much were you paid for your eggs?
So I don't remember the exact number, but I believe it was between 6,000 and 8,000 all in.
Okay.
A little bit of that was paid, like maybe like $500 or $1,000 was paid earlier on in the process for travel. Mm-hmm. And so they took that out of the end sum after completion.
And then, so I'm just thinking about your hospitalization, your home care. I'm sure you had to pay for that. Did you end up worse off financially? Like, how did that all shake out?
Yeah. So I luckily had insurance through my company at the time. And so a lot of it was wrapped up in insurance and, you know, things like that. And there was some things that had to be paid out of pocket right away. Some things got pushed, some things got negotiated down. But yes, definitely not in a better position before any of this. So
I've heard that before, you know, these things happen. And then you went into this to help relieve your financial burden only to be faced with more of a burden.
Yes. And then, you know, and then obviously long-term with my husband and I now trying to have kids, I mean, the crazy amount of money that that takes, you just wonder what's tied to that, what's not tied to that. And so it's just, you know, 3 or 4 times the amount of hospital bills by the time start to finish of what that looked like, you know.
And you've kind of led me to my next question. We're now several years later, many years. How have you mentally or physically healed, and what long-lasting effects do you have from this experience?
So yeah, it's been just over 10 years now, which is crazy to think about. But I will say, as a very short answer, it has been a process. I think you, for me, it was such a, okay, I need to get healthy physically and I need to fix these issues and I need to get back to where I was and be normal. And so I focused a lot of my attention on the physical side and therapies and every sort of thing under the sun that you could do to try to help, you know, your brain come back and help. And so part of the actual physical things that I'm dealing with still to this day is my entire right side. So the stroke happened on the left back part of my brain. And they actually had noticed it. There was one large spot and then there was a couple minor spots that they had noticed. And so they actually think I was having a couple of them, the mini strokes on the, like on the flight that day home. And then I had the one major one that put me in the hospital. Wow. And so, but so it was on my left side. And so it affected the right side of my body.
Right.
And so to this day, I still don't have full sensation. I still don't have full temperature gauging sensations. Like a lot, I still have some nerve damage. Mm. And so I can't feel a lot of textures. I can't feel temperature well. And so I can't, like if something's hot, I have to grab it with my left hand now because I'll actually burn my right hand if I grab it and it's too hot or, sure, or too cold or something like that. And then it feels, the only way I can really describe it. So if you're, say your foot falls asleep or your leg falls asleep,
mm-hmm,
and you start getting your feeling back and you get kind of that tingly,
oh, it's the worst,
pin feelings.
Mm-hmm.
It's a subdued feeling of that.
Oh.
And it's just constant. But now my brain deals with it and, you know, and it just is what it is. And so only if I really pay attention, I can really notice it. But so that's just a constant feeling. So that's physically. Other than that, I was cleared from all like my neural tests and they just said, nope, where you're at is where you're at. You know, there's damage, but you know, that's what it is. But you're healthy. Ovaries went back down in size. There was no scarring, anything like that. So I was very thankful that way. But so back to your original question, you know, I think I spent the first few years just trying to get back healthy and trying to figure out what that even looked like. And then what's been the actual harder, longer journey has been the, I think, just like the emotional impact of what happened and the mental side of what happened and just trying to wrap your mind around, okay, what does this mean for me now? And, you know, you hear all these horror stories of, you know, just, you know, everything, just what's out there, like the breast cancers and the ovarian cancers and the,
mm-hmm,
and fertility issues and, you know, just everything under the sun.
Yeah. Which you and your husband are struggling with infertility now, right?
Yes. And so it has been, and so now doctors can help me. And of course they want our money and all that fun stuff and want to help, but they're not willing to do certain hormones with me because of now I'm predisposed for those things,
right,
where I wasn't before this. Now I am.
Have any physicians or ever told you that they think that this egg donation or the medications you took are responsible for the infertility you're struggling with now?
So they will, but not in so many words. I think that for the most part, and I'm speaking on this not because I know, but this is just kind of my gut on it. You know, just like any industry, I think it's a tight-knit industry. And I think most doctors try to support each other and try to look out for one another. And so I don't think any one of them will come out and directly say, okay, this is malpractice. This is what happened. This is exactly what caused this. But they'll say, so we don't know the root cause, but this probably made it worse. So they'll say it that way.
I see.
To kind of cover their bases and not go out on a limb and say, okay, this was their fault. And of course they can't really know because they didn't test me prior to all of this.
Right.
So it's easy to say, oh, we don't know.
Right.
But I know from my family history, there's no fertility issues on either side of my mom's side or my dad's side. Nothing. So.
Yeah. How many, do you know how many eggs they collected the day of the collection?
So yeah, so that's another interesting part of the story. But I remember doing a little bit of research ahead of time, and they said generally they will retrieve 6 to 10 eggs for a procedure for a family. So if one family is wanting eggs, they will try to retrieve 6 to 10. And that will give them a couple rounds of IVF treatments with multiple, you know, potential, you know, babies and embryos and all those things. And so I knew that going into it. And so on the table when the doctor was retrieving them, that was one of the questions I asked him sitting there, or I should say laying there when he was working on me. And I said, oh, you know, how many did you get? And he said, oh, you did so well. There was 23 that we took from you. And so at the time I was again drugged out. And so I was like, oh, wow, that was a lot, but didn't realize like the extent of what that actually meant. Mm-hmm. Well, so then fast forward. So I, in my mind, I had the number 23.
Right.
And so fast forward, there was some, there was legal channels that were being involved in investigating and malpractice things, investigating, seeing what was going on. And legally the doctor has to record all the eggs. And if they don't, they could lose their license and all those things. So they got those records, and the records that they actually found is he ended up actually taking 45 eggs. So it's just interesting to me. Obviously 45 is just like an egregious number, but
that's insane and way more than one family would
ever need.
Right. And yes, the fact that, you know, for a woman who's struggling with her own infertility and going for IVF, they would never take that many eggs.
Yes. And so, and then just, then the weird side is, okay, why did he even lie to me about, sure, like, and I get 45 sounds awful because it is awful.
Right.
But it's not like 23 sounded any better. And so I'm just trying to understand, like, what was the point of that? Like, I don't, so I am still to this day very confused about the whole situation. And again, it just adds to the kind of the darkness surrounding every piece of the story with me of like, what was, okay, what was true? What was not true? What did the agency know? What did they not know? You know, was just all the different things and the things that I'm questioning throughout the whole process now, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A lot of ambiguity.
Yes, yeah. Very much.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about children who are a result of egg or sperm donation. Do you, after all of this, know where your eggs went?
No. So short answer, no, I have no idea where they went. Mm-hmm. I think by law, just like the doctor had to account for each of those, I think there's somewhere in the world of some sort of documentation that would show where they went. Mm-hmm. But I don't have access to it and have never been able to see it.
Have you joined any DNA matching services to see if you might have a son or daughter in the world?
So I've done one of the, like the standard ones. I don't know if it was 23andMe or, you know, one of those. Nothing has come from that yet for me that would raise any type of questions or tracks, sure, to say, oh, this could be part of it.
Did you, and you kind of alluded to this a little bit, but did you end up pursuing any legal action against the medical team or the agency?
So when I was in the hospital, one of my sisters, so my sister's family was, two of my sisters actually lived in Florida at the time. And one of their family friends had a contact with a lawyer in town, like a very reputable one, and said, hey, if you want, we can look at this just to see what's going on, because this doesn't feel right of what happened. Mm-hmm. And so they had reached out to him when I was in the hospital. And so the only conversations were through my sisters and this lawyer at the time. And so afterwards, when I came out, he approached me and said, hey, if you want to go down this road, I don't mind helping you, just to help cover, you know, potentially cover medical expenses and things like that along the way. And he goes, I don't know what you'll be eligible for. Generally speaking, this is a very hard case to prove medically that it, this is part of it. And it wasn't just you. And he goes, and being international, it's a much bigger elephant because everything just gets wrapped up into legal and, right, you know, insurance this and documentation this and all that stuff. So it was a long process. My lawyer was amazing and kind of helped through the whole process. And he's the one that actually uncovered the doctor taking the 45 eggs and things that I just never would have known along the way.
Yeah.
So I'm very thankful for, you know, his help kind of through it. So luckily I was fortunate enough to have someone like that, that could help me have a voice in the process, mm-hmm. And not just get lost in a lot of the contract stuff that I, unfortunately, most women that are in a position like me get stuck in.
Yeah. Wow. It's a very impactful story. And I think it's one that really needs to be told. So thank you. I'm going to wrap up because we are getting close to running out of time with you. What would you say to any listener that might be considering selling her eggs?
So my short answer is, number one, from my heart, I would absolutely say just don't do it. And I don't mean to say that like, oh, just don't do this. There are so many other avenues that you can take to help families in need if you're looking at being helpful, if you're looking at it from a standpoint of wanting to try to have children of your own, and then you're engaging with an egg donor. So many lives are affected because of a very small gesture, and you are potentially impacting the rest of your life along with three or four other families' lives. And you don't realize your small piece of that pie. You don't realize how connected you are to that. And I would just say, number one, do your research. That's the one thing I wish I would have done more of and just really fully understood what was happening. But there's so many other better ways that doesn't affect your health physically, mentally, emotionally. And you just don't want to play with, you don't want to play God, basically, is how I would like to say that.
Yeah.
You know, and whether you believe in him or not, I do. And I'm, you know, I think he's the only reason that I'm still here. And I think that my story, I hope I can tell people the, like I said, the dangers, like, but to me, there's dangers everywhere, you know, and there's health risks everywhere. This, I had a very extreme case, and I pray that no one has to go through that, what I'd went through, but the long-term effects are the emotional effects and the mental effects and, you know, damages to relationships and damages to potential children that you don't even know are there yet, you know? And so there's just, it's just this like massive ripple effect of choices based on one very small choice. And so if I could, you know, like I said, from my heart, just, it's not worth it. It is absolutely not worth it.
Thanks for sharing that. You mentioned, you know, and your story is a very extreme case. Have you met any other women though that have donated their eggs and have had poor outcomes or bad side effects?
So I don't know anyone personally who has done what I've done. I've met plenty of women and moms who have gone through the IVF cycle. So they've tried to, they're on the other, like they're on the receiving end, if mm-hmm. you will. And I mean, there's a ton of health things that come with that. And again, not quite like my story, but you know, fertility issues and hormone issues and a lot of, you know, depression things later on down the line that they've tied to some of the extreme hormone swings that come with those things.
From taking the drugs during.
Yes. And so I've seen a lot of those stories, not quite from just donating.
Well, is there anything else, Kylie, that you would like to add or share with us before we let you go and get back to your evening?
Not really. I would just like to obviously tell you, thank you for having me on your show. I am very grateful just to be able to share just one story of many that are probably out there. And thank you to Jennifer Law for introducing us. And I appreciate everything that she does. And just if I can say that anyone that's listening that is, you know, thinking about doing this or in the process of doing this or has done this, there's so much freedom in sharing and community and just getting out there. And so what you guys are doing is just absolutely incredible of sharing information and just gaining a little bit of insight and knowledge into this is just huge. So thank you for letting me share.
Oh, of course. I appreciate your vulnerability and your authenticity. You can read about Kylie's story online at legalizedsurrogacywhynot.com. And you can find the award-winning documentary where she's featured, Exploitation Free, on Amazon Prime. Again, we thank you for spending some time with us. It is imperative that you continue to tell your frightening story. And I want to thank each one of our listeners and subscribers. I hope we continue to challenge you to think beyond the masses.
Thanks for listening to Venus Rising. If you like our show and want to know more, check us out at cbc-network.org. Leave us a review on iTunes, too, and join us next week for another conversation on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health.